thank you very much. It's an absolute delight to be back in Cape Town. I came here in 2006 to a conference, and at that time I had my children with me, and we were able to do a bit of a holiday as well, and the children completely fell in love with this bit of South Africa. We went down to the Cape and drove around, and they sadly are now a little bit older and unable to come with me. But thank you very much for bringing me out to South Africa, and also for involving me in this summer school. I'm going to talk, of course, the school is really on living longer and living well, and in order to be able to understand what that means, I think we have to understand whether living longer is also about living healthier. But I want to start by telling you a story, and it's about a man called Gert Bungard, and we don't know much about him, except we know he was a foot soldier, we know he came from lowland Europe, we know he served under Napoleon, we know he was born in 1700, and we know he was the world's first super centenarian. He died at 110. In the 18th century in Europe, there are 10 verifiable centenarians. We've always had long-lived people. It's not particularly new to reach 100, and as I say, people were living to 110 300 years ago. What is different, and what we've seen particularly over the last 50 years, is the mass aging. We've always had people who reached up here, but now we've got so many more people living longer and longer. And whereas in the old days one had to be pretty fit and healthy, I'm sure Gert was unbelievably healthy if he was born in the early 18th century to get to 110, nowadays we increasingly can have people who probably aren't actually that fit and healthy, but due to the kind of modern society, medicine, technology, other interventions, we're keeping people alive longer and longer in a state of health which maybe is not optimum, and their health isn't optimum, not the fact that they're alive. And therefore we are entering actually a very, very different world, and that's really what I want to explore with you today. So I think the main thing that most governments are talking about is this. We're having to raise retirement ages across the developed world. And in fact, this talk is going to be basically on what is happening in advanced economies, although we are seeing both within different countries and within different regions the transitional economies also catching up. But most of the data I'm going to give you is going to come from the advanced economies. And this is why the retirement age must go up. And the reason why the retirement age must go up isn't actually just because we're all living longer, it's because of the other big driver that is affecting the 21st century from a population point of view: we're not having enough children. In so much as we're no longer replacing ourselves. And if you look at those populations that have the lowest total fertility rate, that's the lowest number of children per women of reproductive age, it isn't anymore the European societies, it's actually the Asian societies. Korea, Singapore, Hong Kong, urban India, I've just come back from Kerala, 1.6 now in the whole state of Kerala. And in many, many parts of Latin America, below replacement. In fact, 2/3 of the world's countries are now below replacement. So we have, instead of had this kind of a pyramid, where we had lots of young people coming into our societies, driving our economies, and supporting the small number of older people, we're getting what we call a skyscraper. And that's really, really good news. We should be very, very positive about this. This means that roughly 10% of the population is a floor and it's a decade of life. So the skyscraper population, and the US will be a skyscraper, no longer a pyramid, but a skyscraper by 2020, and the majority of the advanced economies will be skyscrapers by about the middle of this century. And that means that the majority of people who are born do not die across the life course. They live long, long, healthy lives. But it means that we don't have young people coming into our labour markets in the way that we used to. I think in this part of the world it's slightly different. And obviously Africa in particular, that is where the youth of the world is going to be for probably the most of this century. But in Europe, we are simply not replacing ourselves. And unless we have a migration of skills from other parts of the world, and that's becoming increasingly less likely, we're going to have issues around driving our economies. So one of the reasons why we're saying people should be working longer is because, as I will show in a minute, at least in the early ages, we are living longer and healthier, and therefore able to be active and contributory. And in a way, we are compensating for the lack of younger people coming into our labour markets. And what I hope you get out of this course is two very, very big messages about population ageing. And that is, and I think hopefully we'll show this in a minute, that if you look at what is happening to people in their 60s, 70s, really into their mid-80s in many parts of the advanced world, then they are fit and healthy and able to contribute. And that is really about just being an active, healthy adult for as long as possible. But we have this other group, which are really those people over 80, probably over 85, increasingly living into their 90s, and as I'll show in a minute, living up to a century. And there we are keeping people alive in frailty and dependency for far, far longer. And that is a very, very different picture. So what we're trying to say is we need to get away from sort of chronological age as a marker and say whilst adults are active and fit and able to contribute, we should enable people to stay within our labour markets and to stay within our communities and within our educational establishments and with active within families and households for as long as possible, and then put our resources onto the oldest old. And I think you can just keep that message in the back of your mind. But let's start. I'm going to show you some maps and some statistics. But first of all, I'm going to look at some questions. And these, I think, are key. Sorry, this is a bit. Continue the speaker. I think there are these key questions that we really have to understand. And I'm going to put them up now, and I'm going to come back to them at the end of the lecture. And the key questions are the following. Will increases in both life expectancy and life extension or longevity continue? In other words, will there be a increase in the average years lived by humans and also the maximum years attained by a human being? Sometimes people confuse life expectancy and longevity. If you like, life expectancy is the average of the whole population. Are we going to get everybody living long lives? And longevity is how long can we stretch out the longest life? Does anyone know what the longest life is?
121.
22. Very good. And what gender?
Lady.
Spot on. There you are. Absolutely. Therefore, in our minds, we think, oh, can a human live longer than 122? That's longevity. Life expectancy is where you have over 60% of your population making it to 80 or 85. So, will life expectancy increase in line with life extension? Will we all enjoy the benefits of longevity, or will it only be for a few? We'll look at some data around that. Will increases in life expectancy be accompanied by increases in life extension, or are we seeing a compression of longevity after 100? In other words, is it that we're just going to get everybody living to a century, but then people are going to die pretty quickly after that, or will the tail continue to go out? So as we get more people living to 105, 110, 115, so we find maximum life extension continuing. And will advances in life expectancy be matched by advances in healthy life expectancy? And that really, I think, is the key of this whole lecture. So here we've mapped female life expectancy at birth. And if you look at the yellow, that's female life expectancy at birth over 80. Now I'm going to be talking about life expectancy, and I'm going to give lots of different figures. Some of the figures are going to be projections into the future. This is actual life expectancy. So this is the life expectancy 2005 to 2010 from the UN Population Division. And you can see that in many of the advanced economies, women now at birth have a life expectancy at the national level of over 80. And you can see also that really it's only here where you still have reasonably low life expectancies under 60. So you can see the huge disparity at the regional level. Let's look at men. And this is male life expectancy at birth. And I think you can see instantly, no yellow. There is not yet a country in the world where men have reached life expectancy at birth of over 80. And in fact, for men, it's even worse. Remember, there were some blue countries in Africa. but almost the whole of Africa, it's under 60 at the national level. That doesn't mean within society you don't get differences, but at the national level. And similarly, you can see, look at this, I mean, South Asia, and across here, there was a recent piece of research came out of Oxford last week, which is tremendously low life expectancies of men in Russia, which they think is probably to do with alcohol, but it's also to do with smoking, alcohol, stress, etc. So we kind of put them together here so you can see it. And the one question I'm often asked is, why is it that women live longer than men? And is it that the gap is going to close? Well, there are basically three reasons, or three broad sets of reasons, why women outlive men. One of them is socioeconomic, and it is very clear that men at all stages of their life actually do more dangerous activities. So homicide, suicide, gang warfare, etc., dangerous driving, it's all higher among young men. They tend to do more dangerous occupations. So you can say from sort of social points of view, they tend to have behaviours. Men tend to smoke generally more than women. Men tend to drink more than women. So socially and economically, you can say that yes, men have those kind of behaviours, but we could change that. And a lot of people say that the younger women coming through, they are taking on male behaviours, and therefore maybe we will see a compression of that difference. But the biologist also points out that there are other fundamental biological differences between men and women. One of them is around our immune systems. And the message around immune systems is mixed for the women in this room. In so much as we now know that the female immune system is better at fighting viruses and bacteria than the male immune system. That's the good news. The bad news is that man flu probably exists, so when he's whinging about how awful he feels, he probably does feel worse than we do, so anyway. The other really big thing is the hormonal system. As you know, we can very broadly say that women's bodies for a lot of their lives is driven by estrogen and males' bodies by testosterone. And we've known for a long time that estrogen protects. But what we're now beginning to realise that testosterone doesn't only not protect, it may even enhance mortality. And there's this wonderful study that came out of Korea where they had a lot of historical data around the Korean courts. And what they've been able to show over many decades is that the eunuchs, the castrated men, lived on average 20 years longer than the uncastrated men. So the message to the men in the audience is, if you want to live longer, let's look at this and just see how it sort of panned out, basically. And this is going to be, this is English data. And the reason why I'm using English data is because, not only because I come from England, but because the English records and the Swedish records historically are some of the best in the world, because we had fantastic church records. So we really can understand births and deaths from a historical point of view.
Sorry, I thought I'd switched
to you. That's okay, and if you hadn't said anything, no one would have known exactly who it was. But
we made it at the start.
Yeah, we made it a bit more interesting, yeah. So, do you remember I was talking about deaths across the life course and how we've conquered deaths across the life course? And you can see very clearly here. In 1851 in England, this is the proportion surviving to each successive age. Sorry about this. And these are the ages along the bottom. And you can see that in 1851, people just died across the life course. And what we've done is we've pushed death out. By 2011, you can see really death becomes pushed into old age. And we've done it so much so that in 1851, half the English population was dead before they reached 45. Mm-hmm. And now we can say that half the English population is alive at 85. We've pushed death right the way back. Now, sometimes a lot of governments use this kind of longevity as a way of saying, right, we're all living longer, and therefore that's an excuse for putting our pension age back and back, and definitely a lot of European governments are doing this, and the UK government is pushing state pension age back. It's now, I think, just about to hit 68, not for the current cohort, but already cohorts who are in the labour market will face 68, and it will be 70, without any doubt. I would say within about 10 to 15 years, they will have pushed it back. But if you're going to take that, you actually have to be quite careful, because when Bismarck introduced the old age pension into Europe, he fixed it at 65, and half the European population was dead at 45. So today's equivalent, the European state pension age, should be 103. Mm-hmm. And that brings us into something that I think during the rest of the course you're going to be thinking about. Obviously, retirement isn't just about money and pensions, it's also about things like rest and reward and a civilized society that has a period of leisure at the end of working lives. But let's look at exactly what happened. We can say that first of all, we've conquered a lot of these deaths across the life course, this bit here, through basic things like sanitation, nutrition, clean water. Then we had public health initiatives which moved on to have safe childbirth clean housing. Then we moved on in the middle of the last century to look at issues around things like antibiotics, and in fact penicillin was discovered at Oxford, and that made a huge impact. And then in the end of the 20th century we introduced late life medicine, geriatric care. And one of the really big things that we as demographers didn't see, even 25 years ago, that the big pushback in the reduction in mortality would be in the over 65s. And in fact, we sort of had this idea that we would push infant and child and mid-adulthood mortality back, but we still thought people were going to die when they hit 65, 70. That's where we've made these tremendous gains. So let's look at this period, which is 1911 to 2011, basically last century, and let's see at how death, what happened to death last century. So this here we've taken again, this is UK data, and it's just for men, and we've taken across the last century causes of UK male mortality. And you can see basically we have red is infections, green is respiratory, yellow is cancer, and blue is circulatory. And let's look first of all at this one, respiratory. And you can see that respiratory diseases were responsible for killing quite a large number, particularly of older men, and this is the influenza epidemic after the First World War. But across the century, we began to cure things like pneumonia. Pneumonia used to be called the old man's friend. Now, of course, people don't die of pneumonia, and sometimes they stagger on and die of cancer and various other things. So, but that's good news. I mean, we really have more or less eliminated respiratory. The same with infections. You can see here, this is First World War, this is Second World War, but basically people don't die from infections anymore. The very old and the very young still succumb. And there is, of course, this big debate about antibiotics. Is it that we are going to have all these diseases coming back? And in fact, the UK at the moment is obsessed with this. When I talk to my colleagues who work with infectious diseases, their view actually is that because we understand the genetics of the pathogen as well as the host, we will always be ahead of actually conquering infections and infectious diseases. But it'll come at a cost. It's going to be more and more expensive in order to stop people dying from infections and from infectious diseases. And the cost element is something that will continue to come out through the talk. But let's look at this one. This is cancer. This is really interesting. See, cancer really, it actually went up in the 70s. We've had a little bit of a decline. I think that's slightly lower. But basically, cancer, we haven't done much with cancer across the 20th century. And my colleagues who work in cancer medicine, they say that is because incidence has gone up, and that's probably because of our lifestyles. We eat the wrong food, we smoke, we drink, we don't do enough exercise, maybe environmental stresses, chemicals in the environment, etc. But our ability to stop people dying from cancer has also gone up. So people don't die as much from cancer. But this is the one I really want to concentrate on. This is circulatory. And remember, this is men, and it was more or less right up until about the 80s. And then something happened in the UK, and tremendous fall, really significant fall. Does anyone know what happened? What happened around about here?
Men stopped smoking.
People stopped smoking. And again, came out of Oxford, Richard Peto made that link between particularly lung cancer, stroke, cardiovascular disease, and smoking. Men in the UK gave up smoking, and basically, they stopped dying of stroke and heart disease. And it was at such a level that we could see. And here, I'll just show you. This is heart disease deaths per million males. And again, you see, this is 1980. You can see, look at that reduction that we had going through. And cancer and stroke-related deaths, similarly, all the way down. Now, this is a really, really interesting picture because that was a very, very simple thing. That was a public health measure. We said to men in, well, we said to everybody in the UK, but given that men were really the smokers, stop smoking and your health will improve. And they stopped smoking and male mortality fell quite dramatically. I think we can say that if smoking was the epidemic of the 20th century, this is probably the epidemic of the 21st century, obesity. So the really big question is, what is going to be the impact on obesity on life expectancy? And people often say this to me, is it not that people in their 20s and 30s are already, and children, so obese that actually life expectancy is going to go down? And the really big question is it going to kill people, or is it just going to disable them in later life? Are we not in a world where we can keep people suffering from the chronic conditions which obesity encourages for longer and longer? So let's look at some of the evidence. And I'm going to take some work which came out of the United States just to show you. So this is a map of obesity in the United States. 1986, you can see that the majority of the states, we didn't have any data, people weren't collecting data on obesity, but you can see even those that did have it, it was under 10%, that's less than 10%. And then this is the key here, up to at the bottom, over 30%, that's over a third of the population. And I'm just going to run this through, it's on a timer, and just look at what happened to obesity in the United States. Okay. So that's 15% has come in. The first 20% in 1998. Here we have 25% by the turn of the century, 30%. And we've actually got there a couple of states that are over 35%. Huge increase in obesity in just roughly 25 years. Now the really big question why this is interesting is because of two studies that happened to be occurring at the same time. And the interesting question that these studies were focusing on was, in some countries, particularly in the US, mortality is much higher than should be expected. The US has mortality that is in the second half of the OECD. It's below average. And is it because of obesity? So if we got rid of obesity in the United States, would we be able to reduce the mortality of the population? But it isn't just the United States, because the study that I'm going to show you also has a variety of other countries in it, and if you look, we've got the US there, that's actually 35% of the population. This is, I think, women on this particular graph, but we've obviously got it for men as well. But look at Spain and England, they don't do very well either. And it's only really Japan, which we know has very long life expectancy, that still has really low obesity. So, I'm going to describe these two studies to you because I think it was quite striking. The first study was called the Prospective Studies Cohort. And it was done out of Oxford, and it was done between 1979 and 1996. And it was asking this question, how much does obesity contribute to death, basically? And then it stopped. And at the same time, in around about 1996-1997, two researchers out of the state, Mehta Chang, they started doing exactly the same kind of analysis, and they ran it from 1996 to 2006. And you can actually see here, this is the percentage of the female gap. In other words, if there wasn't obesity, what would the life expectancy be like? And they suggested that 41% of the unexplained deaths in the US were explained through obesity. But the Mehta Chang did exactly the same, and they only suggested that it was 22%. So in other words, what we're saying, at a time when obesity was quite low, the study was suggesting actually it had quite a large impact on death, and as obesity grew in the States, it seems to have much of a lower impact. And so people have tried to tackle this to try and understand, and the main reason that the researchers have come up with is this: drugs. In other words, we're now in a society where we can pop a pill and it will significantly reduce the impact of high blood pressure, high cholesterol, diabetes, etc., etc. And that we are probably living in a society, because it's mainly driven by interest, particularly in the state, the HMOs and the insurance companies, the big pharma interests we have, that we are educating the population to say, you don't have to worry about eating too much and drinking too much and not doing enough exercise, because you can always take a pill. And because we have been using drugs so much over the last two decades, even though our population has got more and more obese, actually deaths from obesity have been reduced. And that gives us a very different scenario. We have the 20th century epidemic, which is smoking, and public health in the UK conquered that, and we saw a dramatic fall in mortality. And then we have obesity in the 21st century, and at the moment, we're not tackling it so much from a public health point of view, we're tackling it from a drug point of view. But the implications of that means these people will still have chronic conditions in their 50s, their 60s, their 70s, their 80s, their 90s, but we'll be keeping them alive. And that has massive implication going forward for that question, life expectancy versus healthy life expectancy. So we can come back to that in a minute, because I just want to move on to another aspect of the questions. And this is inequality in mortality. And to a certain extent, this one is tackling that question which asked, will life expectancy and longevity be for the few or for everyone? Are we going to be pushing back life expectancy, or are we going to have longevity increases in a very specific, probably well-educated, high-income aspect of our society? Now, many of you may have heard the Marmot study, which was the Whitehall study, where they took roughly about, the original study was about 5,000 civil servants, and they looked at the huge inequality in life expectancy between, say, the man who delivered the post and the head of the civil service. Well, we've just been working with a group, it's called the Club Vita dataset, and we now have 2 million occupational pension records, and 500,000 of those people are dead. And so we have actually got tremendous power on understanding the differential in life expectancy and some of the drivers behind it. And I just want to take you through some of this. And the thing to remember is these people with occupational pensions, we're not talking about, you know, labourers, people who are, you know, sweeping and cleaning the underground. We're talking about people who are salaried people because they've got occupational pensions. Already we've taken away that lower socioeconomic group in the UK, and already we're looking at a higher economic group. So one of the things we did was we just compared UK life expectancy from age 65, and we divided them up into two distinct groups. At one end, this is just men I'm showing you, at one end we had our low income, ill health, retiree with an unhealthy lifestyle. And again, remember this, just think about this, we're going to come back to that. And at the other end we had our high group, high income, normal health retiree with a healthy lifestyle. And as you can see, at age 65, the low-income group had about 12 years of life expectancy. The high-income group had 23 years. That's an 11-year difference between these two groups. And here we've mapped it, or put it into a figure. So the healthy lifestyle is the blue, and this is the probability of reaching the next age, and you can see up 100% we start at 65 because it's life expectancy from 65, and you can see that the blues have got a really good probability actually of reaching these higher ages. The green are the unhealthy lifestyle, who fall quite dramatically, and when you actually compare it at something like 85, the difference is quite dramatic. Here we have about 70% down to about 20% likely. Why is that? So one of the things we did was try and tease out what were the drivers of this difference in life expectancy. So the impact of different factors on longevity. We took our manual employee, poor, unhealthy lifestyle, ill health retiree, who has 12 years at age 65. If he had retired in normal health, we could have added 1.8 years on. If he had had a healthy lifestyle, 4.6 years. If he had a high income, less, 4 years. And if he'd done a non-manual job, actually less than a year. We were really surprised at that. This obviously was the one that came out at the top, the healthy lifestyle. So the picture is really becoming, I think, more apparent. It is, to be perfectly honest, health across the life course. And again, this is something that I know this course is going to talk about. It is preparing for one's later lives, preparing when you're a child, preparing when you're young, preparing when you're in midlife, preparing when you first retired, keeping fit and healthy. We're also going to talk about financial preparedness. I think Kate's going to talk to you about that tomorrow. But this idea of maintaining a healthy lifestyle is clearly very important. I'm sorry about this. I don't quite know what to do. I'm just too near to the speaker, sadly.
Does that help? Can you still hear?
Can you all hear me?
Okay. Is that better?
Yeah.
Are you trying?
Okay. I just wanted to show you this because we also picked up some regional effects on mortality, which were very, very interesting. So what we have done here, I'll just talk you through this. On this side, we have taken the top local areas across all these different regions in the UK. And don't worry about them in any kind of detail. Just for interest, this is the North East, North West, and this is Wales and Scotland. But you can see that if you live in one of the top areas in terms of our indices of basically, it's basically an economic indice, that actually your life expectancy in all these regions is more or less the same, and there's very little differential. So in other words, in here we've got some of our low-income poor people who happen to be living in a very rich area of, say, East England or London or the South East, and their life expectancy has actually sort of been boosted by living in those areas. If, however, you live in one of the poorest regions, the poorest local areas within all the regions, huge differential and really weird things. Say, for example, if you live in Cornwall, whether you are... the variance is quite extraordinary. So very, very low. If you live in Wales, you've got huge variance, but actually at this end it's very high. So what we think we've picked up is the following. Remember, we're looking at everybody living in these areas. So if you are a poor person, but you live in a very wealthy area, there is an area effect. Probably because the local services are very good. You've got good hospitals, good health clinics, good accident and emergency, etc. If, however, you're living in one of the poorer areas of the UK, then it actually matters whether you're rich or not. So if you're a rich person, you can actually buy yourself good health care. But if you're a poor person, you really are dragged down. And that's why UK financial planners are actually very interested in this, because it actually has sort of huge implications for sort of postcode lottery and sort of understanding longevity by postcode. I'm just going to sort of start rounding up now, but I really want to focus on this question, which is about So that question was on life expectancy and differentials in life expectancy. This one turns to look at the one which is the correlation between life expectancy and healthy life expectancy. And really the debate, I think, is still not clear. As we are getting older, are we, as we're living longer, are we actually living healthier during those years? But I'll show you the up-to-date evidence that we have. There is clearly a high correlation between life expectancy and healthy life expectancy. So, for example, this is life expectancy at 65, this is healthy life expectancy at 65, and you can see we have a nice line here with the Baltic states, low life expectancy, low healthy life expectancy, and Iceland has very high life expectancy and also very high healthy life expectancy. So at the national level, there is clearly a correlation. This is, don't worry about this, this is some kind of a meta-analysis where we've taken studies, and these studies are from, this is the top one is the US, Manton is the US, we've got Japan, we've got Singapore, we've got Germany. And basically what they are saying is that as life expectancy increases, the period of time you spend in disability also seems to increase. So we can look at this in more detail by looking at this particular study. And this was done again out of the UK, a woman called Carol Jagger, who is an epidemiologist. And I'm just going to take you through these scenarios because it's actually quite interesting. So what they did was they projected forwards life expectancy versus healthy life expectancy in the UK at 65. So they've got three scenarios for the changing relationship between life expectancy at 65 and what we're going to call disability-free life expectancy. And these percentages, down here, they refer to the proportion of remaining life expectancy that is disability-free. So let's say, when they looked at just ageing, they said, let's ignore the future health profile of the UK population, but we know it's going to age. In 2006, people at 65 would have another 16.7 years without disability, and they would have 1.8 years with disability. So that's what we did. Projecting forward 20 years, the life years without disability is going to increase, but so is the life years with disability. What about in poorer health? What if we say that the UK population health in general is going to go down? Actually, it's the same kind of idea in 2006, because we know what that is. In 2026, life years without disability falls down a little bit, and life years with disability goes up just a little bit, but not much. And what about if we had improving health? What if we really can, as I'm suggesting, boost the health of the population? We know what it was in 2006. Yes, life years without disability goes up 19.5 as opposed to 18.5 if we're in poor health. And life years with disability also falls slightly, but only slightly. So I think the message is this, that what is happening, and that is increasing public health initiatives and the use of drugs and geriatric medicine in the post-65 means we are pushing back the onset of disability. But the drivers that are enabling us to keep healthier for longer are also enabling us to keep people alive with chronic disabilities longer. So it's sort of a double-edged sword. We will probably stay healthy well into our 80s within the next 20, 30 years, but we will have a slightly increased period of time with disability. If that's the case, then actually that's not too bad a scenario, in fact, because the really important thing is keeping people fit and healthy and active for as long as possible, and then making sure that the resources are put in those later years of life. But I want to talk finally about this, which is radical longevity. Because radical longevity then goes into that fourth question, which is, as we push back more and more people into over a century, are we also going to be pushing the tail forward? Now, I can actually say that the epidemiological evidence we have at the moment comes from Japan, where they have a sufficient number of centenarians to be able to say yes. As Japan is getting more centenarians, it's getting more super centenarians. more people living over 110 up to 115. But what about this real radical longevity? So far we've talked about things like conquering disease, that's why we're all living longer. Enabling people to live with chronic conditions, that's why we're living longer. What about things like age retardation medicine or genetic and longevity research, where we're actually trying to manipulate the genes in the body so we can live longer? Well, I think this is something that has huge potential and it's just around the corner. And I'm going to quote, Paul Fairchild works with me in Oxford. I run the Institute of Population Aging, and that's in something called the Oxford Martin School, which is the school for the 21st century, and he runs the Stem Cell Institute. And he is one of a large collaboration across the globe, I think there's about 350 other stem cell institutes, that are working on stem cells. Now, one of the problems with stem cells is that there basically, up until now, have been two ways that you get stem cells. You get adult stem cells, and they are where you take an adult's stem cells and you can put it into their own body, and that really is fantastic against adult leukemia, but that's about it. You can't reuse it for anything else. And the second thing, of course, is embryonic stem cells. There's huge issues with that from a medical point of view, massive issues around rejection, but also huge, huge ethical issues about using unborn children in this way. But what we are now finding coming out of research is this. It is now possible to take a human skin cell, to reprogram it, to turn it into a stem cell, to then reprogram it again so that it becomes a stem cell which is therapeutic for macular regeneration of the eyes, or replacing part of the heart, or replacing ligaments in the leg, and all three have now been done, and you place it back into the human being. And this is not only being done in the lab, it's also being done out in the community. And when you think about the potential of something like that, that is just around the corner, it is huge. We also have colleagues who are working on 3D printing. You can now 3D print a working human heart, etc., etc., etc. So the whole issue around radical longevity means we, I think, will be asking questions this century, and probably this half of this century, how long do we want to live? 120, 150, 200? Because science is pushing us this way, and yet obviously from a social, economic, ethical, moral, environmental aspect, there are huge questions which need to be asked. But science is pushing us so fast that we already know this. Massive interest in the last few years on centenarians, and the reason is this. I'm just going to give you the UK and Europe. This is the projected number of centenarians in the UK, and one of my colleagues at Oxford, George Leeson, at the end of 2012, he did some modelling of the projected number of centenarians. And we went, no, you're wrong, this cannot be right, go away and do it again. And about a month later, DWP, that's the Department of Work and Pensions, and ONS, the Office of National Statistics in the UK, which are not the most wacky way out people at all, they came out with this projection, which is even bigger than the one that George suggested. This is 2000, this is 2070, this is 100,000 up to 700. And we have roughly about 12,000 centenarians in the UK. By the middle of the century, we will be approaching 500,000, and by the end of the century, we will have 1 million centenarians in the UK. Europe is going to have about 15 million centenarians by the end of the century. Roughly about 8 million people in the UK, we know we'll probably make it to a century. And I'm sure if you did the statistics here in certain sectors of society in South Africa, you would get the same. And part of it is this. This is nothing to do with radical longevity. This is what's happening now. This is sensible demographers. A lot of this comes out of the Max Planck Institute, Bar-Pell and colleagues. And what they have done is they have mapped the future real life expectancy of current babies that are being born today. And one of the things he argues is that half the baby girls born in Europe at the end of last century will live in 3 centuries. So my daughter was born in 1996 and has a really good chance of living into the 21st century. Mm-hmm. And what he's done here, he's mapped the oldest age at which at least 50% of the birth cohort is still alive. So 50% of the population. And you can see the 2007 birth cohort in Canada, 50% are likely to make it to 104. France, Italy, Japan make it to 170, UK 103, and the USA 104. And this is just through general pushing back in the kind of ways I've been talking about, not through radical longevity or gene manipulation. It's just that we are really pushing back late life expectancy. So, our questions to finish. Will increases in both life expectancy and in life extension or longevity continue? I think yes, but if anything, we're going to increasingly probably see huge inequalities in life expectancy and the ability to attain longevity. To put it in some kind of perspective, the longest lived people in the world at the moment are actually the French women and Japanese women. They both live to 88, and men in Sierra Leone have a life expectancy of 35. So inequality, I think, is going to dominate this century. But yes, I think we will slowly see these increases. Will life expectancy increase in line with life extension? Well, basically, the follow-on from what I've been saying is that's not clear. We may well find in the advanced economies people living well post 110, and still in some parts, particularly of South Asia and here in Africa, people dying, and therefore the life expectancy under 60 in this region compared with over 80 in the advanced economies, and that may still continue. Will increases in life expectancy be accompanied by increases in life extension, or are we seeing a compression of longevity after 100? Well, we've already said the Japanese evidence is no, the bell curve is going out and out, the tail is going out. We are seeing super centenarians as we get more centenarians. And will advances in life expectancy be matched by advances in healthy life expectancy? Probably yes, but we are going to see an increase in later life disability as we do push healthy life expectancy forward. Oh no, I was meant to show you a picture of Oxford, but I tell you what it is, it's, there's a timer that keeps, so if you just watch very quickly. I can go on a fiddle with it, it doesn't matter. There you are, thank you.
Going to take 5 questions. Sarah, do you want to manage it, or
I can manage it.
Okay.
Well, in theory, I can manage it. Ah, yes.
The BBC announced last night that studies are showing that cancer is really taking its toll on everyone, and you did mention perhaps the reasons why, but they seem to say, you know, the figures are going to escalate and over the world.
Okay, I was on a plane last night, so sadly I didn't see it. There was, however, during the daytime, a thing about breast cancer in women over 70. And we know that cancers increase as we get older. Cancer is probably a byproduct of aging. If you understand that, and it's complicated, and I won't go into the biology, but basically, in order to keep fit and healthy, we do need our cells to renew and multiply, etc. And there's a very narrow line between healthy multiplication of cells, which is what we need to keep ourselves going, and cells that multiply and become cancerous. And one of the reasons why the WHO has pointed out there will be an increase in cancers is that older people are more vulnerable to cancer. Having said that, because our I'm going to put this very simply, but because you can say that our metabolism slows down as we get older, there are certain types of cancer, if you get them when you're young, they can move very, very quickly. Mm-hmm. If you get them when you're older, you can live with them for a long, long time. Prostate cancer is one of the ones. Mm-hmm. I mean, huge numbers of men live for 10, 15, 20 years with prostate cancer, if they get it later in life. And some of the breast cancers that older women get, again, can be very, very slow growing. But I think the aging population will increase cancer until we manage to to conquer it. And I think we will, because we're really trying to tackle it at a genetic level. But in a way, once we conquer cancer, what is going to kill us?
Tim Noakes, the professor here of sports science, he said on Saturday evening when he gave his lecture that cancer needed glucose. Cancer lives on glucose. And if you change the human nutrition over to eating oils and fats, in other words, you live on ketones and not on glucose, you can kill your cancer cells off just like that. No more cancer.
I agree with you. I think there is, I mean, I'm not a cancer specialist at all, but there definitely is evidence. And if you saw, I mean, it was amazing when you think about it, that we had, when I looked at all those diseases, everything had come down except cancer. Now it has come down, it's just there's so much more. And a lot of people are looking at things like diet and lifestyle as promoting cancer. And the fact that we have these, you know, high fat, fructose based American diets, etc. So I think there is a lot of research at the moment that is looking at things like the impact of diet. And our diets have changed out of all recognition, even in my lifetime. My children eat things that, you know, just we just never ate as children. So I agree with you. But I think cancer is around for a while, and there will be different ways of tackling it, probably. There's a lady at the back. Wasn't there a lady at the back? Yes, that lady at the back.
I was going to ask you if you've considered what is being thought now in South Africa. Carbohydrates are the biggest rogues in our diet.
I had a conversation with Kate about this. I'm not a diet expert. I know there is concerns about the wrong kind of carbohydrates and diabetes, but I think it's more that, you know, we have moved very, very quickly from a vegetable-based diet with limited meat into a diet that is full of sugars and meat and wheat-based products. So over the last 50 years, we've transformed our diet. So, but as I say, I'm not an expert on this, but yeah, I think diet and nutrition is going to be important.
There is Tim Noakes. This is a book by him on this.
It's currently apparently the best-selling book in South Africa. It's already second printing, and then it just came out.
Wow.
I just wanted to know your comments about Alzheimer's with the increasing age of
That's very true. I mean the neurological, you know, Parkinson's and Alzheimer's, and actually depression. I mean, I think that it isn't so much changes in mental capacity, it is the neurological degeneration. And that is, again, another really big unknown around the corner. Although, you know, we do have evidence that the healthy lifestyles that push back cardiovascular disease, push back from cancer, also have an impact on things like Alzheimer's. We know that. But again, I agree there is potentially a huge burden because it is related to age, particularly at later life. Though, very interestingly, there was a study done in Oxford, and it's called the Optima Study. And what they did was they not only had, they had people with early onset dementia and they followed them. And they also asked for volunteers for a control group. And all these Oxford professors came forward and they were all monitored. So these are Oxford professors, well, they're people who live in Oxford, basically. And what they found was that some of these people who were in the control group then got Alzheimer's, even though there was no indication. When you took that group, those people who didn't know it but were going to get Alzheimer's, out of the control group, the decline in mental capacity, even into your 90s, was negligible.
Sure.
And one of the reasons why we see this fall off in our 80s in particular, in mental capacity, is the data is clouded by all these people who are actually going to get dementia, and they're in the early stages of dementia. Sure. So again, the healthy brain is something where we need a lot more research, because we really do not understand what happens to the healthy brain as it ages, because we have a third, possibly even a half, when we get into very late age, who are going to get some kind of dementia, which may not even be Alzheimer's, it may be another kind of dementia. Mm-hmm. So, yes.
Pressure of the increase in life expectancy, also increase in the 3 years life with disability. This is a big funding question, particularly in a third world country like ours.
Yes.
If you're 103, you're going to live 3 years with disability.
I used to have a researcher who looked at family care in Africa, and I've got a PhD student who's just looking at filial piety and the impact it's having on care in Hong Kong and Singapore. And there was an article in the Herald, it isn't the Herald Tribune anymore, it's the New York International Tribune, whatever they called it, on the Chinese communities in the US and how filial piety, which means that particularly women in their 60s will not, under any circumstances, not only not put their older relative into a home, but will not have services coming into the house because it is their job. And I think you are absolutely right that as we get this mass aging of people into their 80s, and you saw that, and it's just quite extraordinary the amount of people who are going to be living. You know, half the UK population is going to make it 25. Amazing. Or is making it 25. When we have this huge group that are becoming, getting dementia, they're getting chronic conditions, incontinence, etc., that burden is actually something that. And definitely in the UK, we're so obsessed with pensions and who's going to fund these pensions. And actually, the answer is not only planning, but we're going to have to work longer. You know, it is absolutely crazy that we can withdraw from the labour market when we're fit and healthy and take resources from a society that really needs them for this growing number of people post 89.
Can we take just one more question and then we can talk again later in the week?
What about the fact that the children who are now going to look after the elderly are actually getting elderly themselves?
Yeah.
And actually don't have the energy or
Yeah, I mean that is very interesting. One of the things we did, and Kate will talk a little bit about this, we did a big survey with HSBC, 44,000 people in 26 countries, South Africa was one of them, in the over 40s. And one of the things that came up really strongly was the massive contribution of people in their 60s and even the over 70s in providing family care. And in the UK, the fastest growing care group are men in their 80s. Because they're caring for disabled wives, basically. And one of the things I think that has happened, particularly, I mean, all those men who should have died in the 80s and 90s from cardiovascular disease and heart attacks are still alive. But, I mean, when I started all of this, people used to say the diseases of late life kill men, because they tend to be heart attacks, and they disable women. Now they're not killing men, but they're still disabling women. Mm-hmm. Women still get osteoporosis, rheumatoid arthritis, they're more susceptible to falls. And women on the whole, and part of it is just our body mass. You know, our muscles aren't as bulky and as strong, our bones aren't as dense as males. And so as we get older, we are more vulnerable. And you are right, you are talking about children who are caring, in their 60s and 70s, caring for parents in their 80s and 90s, mm-hmm. and you're talking about older people staggering. I mean, my father is 85, my mum is nearly 89. And they're sort of, I mean, they live two doors away from me, but they're sort of caring for each other. But, you know, it's you can see the strain, particularly on my father, as my mother is getting frailer and frailer. Now, that, you know, that never happened in my grandparents' generation. You know, they're long gone.
Thank you very much. You had a really excellent talk. We've got a very, very interesting week lined up. You'll have the opportunity of hearing Kate tomorrow evening. Sarah again Thursday evening, and our two occupational therapists are sitting in the front, and those who are coming along on Saturday morning are in for a very interesting morning too. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much for the illuminating lecture.
Thank you.